You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. This past week in Frankfort, lawmakers arrived to begin the 2013 legislative session of the Kentucky General Assembly. A little later in the program, we'll speak with the 1st District's new state senator, Stan Humphreys of Trigg County. But first, Shelley Baskin sits down with Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston to talk about his first week of General Assembly coverage and what he expects for the weeks ahead.
So, Kenny, now that the General Assembly is back in session, I assume that there's been some pretty big opening shots just for everybody to kind of get in the mood of the new session. So what's been the big things on the plate this week with the General Assembly?
Well, the biggest thing that lawmakers actually had to tackle were their leadership elections. In the Senate, we pretty much knew what was going to happen, but formally, Robert Stivers was elected as Senate president, and they also instituted two other new leaders, Damon Thayer as majority floor leader and Brandon Smith of Hazard as their new whip. On the House side, there was actually a little bit bigger news in that the House Democratic Caucus elected the first ever woman in House leadership. That's Sandy Overly of Paris, and she is their new caucus chairman. And that's kind of a big deal on their side. You know, Kentucky's had female governors. There's currently a woman in Senate leadership, Katie Stein. She's from Northern Kentucky. She's the number two in command as the president pro tem. But the House, oddly enough, has never had a woman in leadership, and so now Representative Overly will fill that role. Outside of that, there's been a lot of talk of bipartisanship. Senate President Stivers has said that gotcha politics, that's gone. But of course, you know, this first week, they've never really even considered any bills or any issues. So it might be really too soon to say if this great bipartisan nature will last through the whole session, but it's at least what lawmakers are talking about this week.
So this is a short session this year, short enough to make it hard for them to work around all the big issues that they've got going on. What do you think are some things that might get left out and have to be taken up later or even in a special session later on?
Well, it's interesting you brought that up because already Governor Steve Beshear has asked legislative leaders to delay redistricting for the 2013 session. And he's willing either to call a special session for it, or there's some that want to deal with it right now. Some would like to deal with it in a special session. And even other lawmakers would like to deal with it in 2014. They have to do something by the 2014 legislative session because they can't run 14 years in basically what are old districts now, running off the 2000 census numbers. So they're already talking about delaying redistricting. House Speaker Greg Stumbo said that he thinks that the so-called mechanics of pension reform, which is basically that task force that they had over the summer, their recommendations are what they're calling the mechanics, you know, putting new hires into a 401k hybrid plan, no cost of living adjustments, a few other technical tweaks like that. Speaker Stumbo expects that to probably pass both chambers, but he said funding for the pensions, which fully fund the actual contribution the state is required to give every year, that would be like an extra $200 to $300 million in 2014 alone when they have to fund a new budget. So he's just saying that a special session should be called for that, for pension funding to be tied with tax reform. So those are at least two special sessions, and you never know what else is going to fall through the cracks or not happen in time to possibly a third special session or all these be just combined into one. So, special sessions are definitely once again on the table, despite the fact that these odd year short sessions, as they call them, because they're only 30 days, were supposed to alleviate the need for special sessions.
Now, as I understand it, the state's universities are going to be seeing some bond money come in for some special projects that they've got going on. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, what happened this week is a lot of the universities got bonding projects. In fact, $363 million in bonding projects that they didn't get in the 2012 budget. And it's kind of interesting because in 2012, you heard lawmakers talk a lot about the state debt and that while these were funds that universities and bonds that the universities themselves were going to issue and it wouldn't come out of the general fund, depending on how you count it, it can still count in the state debt. Well, apparently since the 2012 elections are over, that's no longer a big concern. And so House leadership and Senate leadership and the governor got together, and they have a list. Six of the state's eight universities are getting at least one project. Eastern Kentucky University and Kentucky State are the only ones who don't have shovel-ready projects that are good to go right away. The big winner of this, obviously, is the University of Kentucky, but there's something in there for all the universities, and it's a bill that should have pretty good sailing through.
And what made the bond money for universities doable this year that's different from before?
Well, I think, number one, what happened was all 100 House elections are over now, and so Democrats don't have to worry about holding on to their House majority for at least another year and a half. Second of all, these bonds, the universities apparently, when they came with their budget recommendations, House Speaker Greg Sumbo said they basically asked for too much. They asked for more than they knew they were going to get, but they never budged off that. They wanted all of that. And so what these projects are now are, these are projects that the universities have said, listen, this is going to be our funding source, whether it's going to be all bonds or some private donations. These are projects that have been needed for a long time now. They're quote-unquote shovel-ready. And so that's why these projects made the list. It's a lot of building renovations, dorm renovations, facility upgrades, just general maintenance that needs to be done.
There's a couple of little things that are going on, just kind of pet projects of the various administrative officials in the Commonwealth that are sneaking a little bit below the radar. One of those is industrial hemp. How do you see that going this year? Is this something that you think James Comer, the agriculture commissioner, he's a big proponent of this. Do you think he can see this through in this session?
Well, he's certainly going to try. He got a big endorsement this week from the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, which, as you know, is the state's largest business organization and has great weight around Frankfort. They've come out and said they support industrial hemp. He's got support from three congressmen, from U.S. Senator Rand Paul. So there's clearly building support for this. I think it's a proposal that has a good shot of passing the Senate. Comer is close friends with Senate Agriculture Chairman Paul Hornback. Senator Hornback has already filed a bill on industrial hemp. The question is the Kentucky State Police are still against it. And Governor Steve Beshear and House Speaker Greg Sumbo, both Democrats, have said that they're going to kind of defer to the state police as long as they have issues with industrial hemp. Then the governor and the speaker are going to have issues as well. I think that's the same when it comes to rank-and-file Democratic lawmakers in the House. And so Comer's biggest sell job is going to have to be the Kentucky State Police on this issue. If he can't get them to at least become neutral or to not fight the bill, then chances are it will probably die in the House. But if he can convince them, and he basically has 2 weeks until the General Assembly starts back up again, if he can flip one of the Kentucky State Police or the governor or the House Speaker, then it has a fantastic chance of passing.
So it's been a pretty busy week, but there's still several more weeks to go. What should we be looking for from the General Assembly in the next few weeks?
Well, lawmakers are going to go home for the next 2 weeks and kind of ponder, I guess, even more of these big things that are on the table. Those are also a lot of smaller issues, as we talked about, industrial hemp. You have a statewide smoking ban, which could come up. House Bill 1 is a special taxing district reform bill. Senate Bill 1 is electronic voting for overseas military. So there's going to be about 2 weeks for leaders in both chambers and rank-and-file chairmen to get together and figure out what issues to bring to the table. And when lawmakers return on February 5th, it'll pretty much be a grind until the end of March. It'll be interesting to see if any of the big issues can get passed. They only have 26 days left. That's actually not a lot of time in the legislative process, but they'll figure it out in the next couple of weeks and return on February 5th, and that's when they'll really start getting down to business.
Kenny Colston is Kentucky Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief in Frankfort. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot going on in the Murray City Police Department. It's now welcoming 10 new officers, a new vehicle fleet, and a new revenue source from the taxes placed on package alcohol sales. Crime Prevention Sergeant Dave Howe joins me to talk more about the Murray Police Department. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, glad to be here.
And that title, Crime Prevention Sergeant, is a new title for you. And from my understanding, there are a lot of new titles for different people at the Murray Police Department because of a significant change in leadership over the last 2 years. If you could just kind of run down your new role and then what's been happening at the Murray Police Department.
Sure. The role that I'm stepping into, Crime Prevention Sergeant, includes a number of administrative duties. Crime analysis, statistical analysis of crime trends, grant writing, trying to get additional funding for the department. I will be supervising the school resource officers, and additionally, I'm the public information officer, so I deal with the press and the public.
I'm interested in your statistical analysis of crime within the city. What do you look for when you perform a statistical analysis on either accidents or other types of assault crimes and whatnot in the community?
The big thing is to look for the frequency and the geography of the crimes. Basically, it's going back to something called CompStat, which started back at the New York Police Department back in the 80s. And the idea was to determine where crime happens more frequently, and then you can direct your patrols to be in that area more frequently to help prevent that crime.
Is that new for the Murray Police Department?
It is not new. It has been around since, I want to say, 2004 or 2005, our first crime prevention sergeant started about that time frame.
And also, from what I understand, there's been a 70% change in leadership within the department over the last 2 years. I know it would be really complicated for you to tell us names and positions, but what should the public know about these changes?
Well, the first thing the public should know is that everybody that's been promoted in these positions has been around for quite a while. We had a leadership situation where we had a lot of leaders that had been here for a number of years, and we had very little change over several years. And what happened was a lot of the people at the top ended up retiring all at the same time. We've had 3 out of 4 captains retire in the last year. So that requires a promotion of a sergeant to a captain for each one of those. And so that means 3 new captains and 3 new sergeants and so on and so forth. And then with a couple of new positions that have come out, we've had a almost 70% turnover in leadership in the department.
And with some of the new positions, you do have new school resource officers, 2 school resource officers, correct?
That's correct.
And these, though, we should let folks know, these positions are not responses to the Sandy Hook Elementary shootings.
That's correct. This is a program that has been in the works for some time, for several months. In the past, we've had school resource officers. We had school resource officers in the 90s, and then we had, again, in the mid-2000s, we had school resource officers. The problem with those positions is that they were grant-based, grants that the police department and the school worked on together to get an officer into the school. And at the end of the grant, it was found that the city revenue couldn't support keeping an officer in the school, so those officers ended up going back to patrol. The difference is that this time the officers are funded by the increased revenue from the change in the alcohol laws here in Murray, with package sales going in and more venues bringing in revenue. We've been able to budget for 2 officers to be working in the schools. We have an officer at Murray High School. His name is Nicky Knight. He is a 20-year veteran police officer. He worked at the Murray Police Department and then at Benton Police Department, retired from there, worked at the Callaway County Sheriff's for a while, and is now with us, and he's going to be the school resource officer out there. And then at the middle school, we have Officer Patrick Morris. He is a 9-year veteran of the police department. So it's not like we're hiring brand new people off the street and putting them out at the schools. We've got some veteran officers out there, and part of Pat's job at the middle school is also to cover down on the elementary school.
And that's where we learned about the gentleman with the pellet gun who was near the school, and then a parent volunteer observed it, and rightly so. The school officials shut down or locked down the school, and there was a response from the department.
That's correct. As you said, one of the parent volunteers that was on site alerted Officer Morris, who was at the elementary school at the time, that she saw a gentleman walking with what appeared to be a gun across the street from the school. She alerted him. He talked to the principal there and had them go into what they actually call a lock-up situation, where they get everybody inside the school but don't necessarily go into full security because there wasn't a threat inside the school. But then Officer Morris got on the radio and called for other officers, who quickly provided security around the school and found the individual and determined that actually, he had a pellet gun, and had actually been using it to exterminate squirrels that had gotten someone's attic. So
legally?
Legally, yeah. 100% legally. He wasn't doing anything wrong, just imprudent time with the recent incident at Sandy Hook for him to be walking around the school carrying what appeared to be a rifle. But it was a good opportunity for the school to check out their security measures, and everything worked great. So it was a good first test of the school resource officer program, which just started last week. So
you mentioned the increased revenue from the package alcohol vote here in the city of Murray. Do you have an idea of how much money you're budgeting for this fiscal year just based on that tax revenue?
I don't have the numbers. I would have to talk with Sergeant Clear. She is our new alcohol beverage control officer. She was a patrol officer, patrol sergeant, and she's been a detective for a number of years at the department. She would be the one to have those numbers. But I can tell you that we are having five new officers in the department. The school resource positions are covered by that. We have two additional officers on the patrol force, and then money to cover that alcohol beverage position come from the alcohol revenue.
And historically, that alcohol beverage control position had been housed in the city administrative offices, and now this has moved to the Murray Police Department?
That's correct. It was an entirely administrative position, but with the increase in the amount of everything that's going to be going on and package sales and taverns coming in, it's been moved to the police department, and that way it's got both the administrative and the enforcement functions in the same person.
And lastly, let's talk about the new vehicle fleet. A lot of folks in the city have seen new cars, new Murray police cars driving around. What prompted the new fleet, and how did you pay for it?
Actually, a lot of people have asked if the new fleet is related to the alcohol money or not, and actually it's not. It was a project that was undertaken the first part of last year, first part of 2012. Some research was done into some different acquisition methods to get a fleet. And in the past, we had always just purchased three new cars every year because a patrol car we find lasts about 3 years for us. And then some new acquisition methods were found to where we could get the entire fleet all at once. And actually, it would cost about a third less than it was costing us to out and out purchase these cars. And the cars we've bought, the majority of them are the Taurus Police Interceptor. It is a Ford, and it's a smaller and lighter vehicle, but just as capable as the old Crown Victoria Police Interceptors we had before. We've had them for a couple months now, and we're already noticing a reduction in fuel usage. So sort of double tapping that the saving of money for the city, for the fleet operation there.
Because you've replaced it as one full fleet at this given time, does that mean every 3 years you'll have to replace the full fleet, or will you begin that rotation? You said that you'd replace part of the fleet every 3 years.
I'm pretty sure the plan is to replace the entire fleet every 3 years, but with the acquisition method they came up with, it'll be still cheaper to replace that whole fleet all at once. And that way, everything's about the same age. We don't have the question about, well, which car has the most mileage and that kind of thing.
Well, Dave Howe, the newly minted crime prevention sergeant for the Murray Police Department, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
When we come back, a conversation with Stan Humphreys, who is transitioning into his new role as Kentucky's 1st District State Senator. You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Former Trigg County Judge Executive Stan Humphreys is in his first few days as the 1st District's new state senator, and he's arrived in Frankfort at a particularly auspicious time. The Kentucky General Assembly is set to address a range of issues, from Medicaid and industrial hemp to tax reform and underfunded state employee pensions. To see how he's settling in, I spoke with Humphreys from his office in Frankfort. Senator Humphreys, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me today. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today, Todd.
I'm curious, how are you finding Frankfort so far? Has it been a big adjustment?
Well, I had spent quite a bit of time here, as all judge executives do, so I kind of knew a little bit about the lay of the land, I guess you'd say, but obviously there's been a lot going on this week with the swearing in and all the ceremonial things. Great experience for me to have that opportunity and to share it with my family who was up on Tuesday, and so it's been fast-paced and a lot going on, and we're just here for this week, and then we'll be back in February, but there was just a lot of things being crammed in this week. And
do you know what committees you'll be serving on?
I do. I will be chairman of the Capital Planning Advisory Board, and the Budget Review Subcommittee on Education. I'll also be the vice chair of both the Education Committee and the State and Local Government, as well as serving as a member on the A&R and Agriculture. So a lot of work to be done in each of those.
Well, of all the issues you and your colleagues are going to be considering this session, perhaps the biggest and the toughest one to deal with is pension reform. Kentucky Retirement Systems, for example, only has 44% of the funds it needs to meet its future obligations. So as you're acclimatizing to the halls of the state capitol, are you hearing any solutions suggested to that problem that pique your interest? And what do you yourself see as the way out of this situation?
You're exactly right. That's probably the first and foremost the biggest obstacle that we're facing this session. It's one of those things where probably the can has been kicked about as far as it could be kicked without really delving into it and making some corrections and some changes. And I was interested to hear President Stiver speak this week about the potential about trying to get something done, lay out the guidelines, and come into it next year in the budget session and actually find those cuts to be able to implement the process. But first you have to put a plan in place, and so I think that's where we probably are at this point. Those are some things that are probably going to be discussed and looked at. I think both the House and the Senate understand that, you know, we're at a crossroads here, and you have to make some real tough decisions sometimes on that. And my pledge has been all along that I would support those that have been in retirement system currently working not to have changes made to their current system that would adversely affect them and their retirement.
Turning to the revenue issue, last month, as you know, Governor Beshear heard changes to the state tax code that were recommended by the task force he appointed, some of which were raising the cigarette tax, expanding the state sales tax to additional services, capping individual itemized deductions. Have you seen anything in those recommendations that gives you pause, or have you seen things that you can get behind there?
Well, there, I think there was, 60-some-odd recommendations and from the Senate side. I haven't seen sentiment in the Senate on raising taxes. So we want a tax policy that grows jobs and expands our economy. But this is a revenue measure, and this type of bill would need to come out of the House. So, but I intend to be very vocal about this issue this year as your senator, and that not adversely affecting opportunities or putting undue burden on people who are already stressed and trying to make mortgage payments and put food on the table. So that's where I am at this point in time with that.
Are the universities and colleges throughout the Commonwealth, are they looking at another round of cuts any time in the near future?
Well, you know, it's the last 5 or 6 years, universities have kind of mirrored what has gone on with our personal lives as well. We've seen cuts, and we've seen where we've had to, you know, make do with what we had and didn't have great opportunities to expand what we were wanting to do or those things that need to get done anyway. So I hope that that's not a possibility. I mean, I will make every effort to try to keep that from happening. We don't see those rounds of cuts, because we know that is adversely affecting us for years to come when you start setting a precedence where you don't want to increase opportunities for young people to go to school, attend school. You know, I think you're making a statement and you're making a long-term negative investment in your community when you do that.
Republican Senate President Robert Stivers has come out saying that he backs letting Washington handle the Commonwealth's health insurance exchange, as opposed to setting up a state agency. That's what Democratic House Speaker Greg Stumbo supports. I wonder, where do you fall in that range?
We currently have 800,000 folks on Medicaid in Kentucky, and as we start accepting new enrollees into Medicaid, the managed care through the Affordable Health Care Act, that number goes to 1.2, 1.3 over time. So we have the mandate, but the cost of running these exchanges and the personnel and the people are going to keep these in place for years to come. You know, that money, from what I've seen, has not been given from the federal government for an extended period of time. So how do you run these exchanges is going to be addressed. You know, I would certainly probably weigh with Senator Stivers on this. there's talk of having several states going together with these exchanges. So it is going to be a cost problem for the state, and I don't see any way around the fact that you're going to have cuts in some areas because of this mandate.
Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner James Comer, who is a Republican, is a prominent and vocal supporter of industrial hemp, as is U.S. Senator Rand Paul. Do you see a future for industrial hemp in Kentucky? And what's your sense of the support it has, or doesn't have, for that matter, in Frankfort?
It's my understanding, Todd, even if we pass or to be able to pass something like that, and that's probably several discussions before that something like that could get done, there's been a lot of education and work, and we want to go through a rigorous process of a review and studying on this. But anything that you can do to hopefully increase revenue and increase opportunities in the Commonwealth, not only the first district, but throughout the rest of the state as well, that's going to provide opportunity and economic impact. You really have to sit down and look at it as a means to solving some of our problems. So I realize that's still a ways off, but I do see that there could be potentially some economic impact on it. So we would certainly want to try to at least hear the whole process out and make an educated decision on the viability of industrial hemp in the Commonwealth. It's been a interesting week, and it's sometimes you feel like you're kind of drinking out of a fire hose up here. You're getting a lot at one time, so I'm trying to soak it all in, and as you know, Todd, I try to weigh all the options and make a land on a good decision before I move forward. So I don't. I know there's a lot of things that are going to face our General Assembly this time, and we have, like I said earlier, we have a lot of pressing issues, things that you just can't put off. So we're going to be working on those, and obviously, as you mentioned earlier, with Medicaid. One of my biggest concerns locally, I know the folks at Murray Cowley County Hospital and our health departments and other, my hospital in Katy's and the other hospitals throughout the area, Mayfield and so forth, are really struggling with these MCOs that are not reimbursing from Medicaid. So we're having meetings and trying to work out the details of why our these MCOs, managed care, are not reimbursing, but I know that that's a big issue in our communities, and I'll certainly try to work on getting to the bottom of why aren't we, our communities being reimbursed when they should and have already been paid initially the money to manage these accounts. So that's one of our most critical and urgent passions right now, is trying to get to the bottom of that.
Out of curiosity, where have they put you in terms of your office?
Well, they have given me a pretty nice office, believe it or not, Todd. I guess they weren't sure about where to put me at, so they put me right smack in the middle on the outside wing, and I'm facing the parking lot. Everybody knows kind of where you come to Frankfort. We're in the annex. My office on the second floor, suite 209, and I love to take visitors and have groups up here, and so if they'd like to come, just have them call my office, and one of the secretaries can set something up. So we'd love to see you up here and hear your concerns. That's what we're here for. And it's always good to hear from the folks back home as to what's taking place and what's going on.
So you have a beautiful view of the parking lot.
Well, it could be worse, Todd. It could be worse. There's a lot of great folks here. And this was actually Dr. Winters' office when he first got to Frankfort 8 years ago.
So a nice continuity there.
It is.
Well, State Senator Stan Humphries represents Kentucky's 1st Senate District that comprises Callaway, Carlisle, Fulton, Graves, Hickman, Lyon, and his own Trigg County. Senator Humphries, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Todd, for having me.
Since the beginning of economic woes in the U.S., many Americans who thought they'd retired have reached the conclusion that they can't stay that way. So they look for work to supplement their income, but they face a job market more crowded than they left it, and one that may require skills beyond what they already have. It's a problem Jackie Eubanks wants to help fix. She coordinates a U.S. Department of Labor program called Senior Community Service Employment. It's a work-based training program for older workers. Kate Lochte sat down with Eubanks to find out more.
Jackie, you've been in employment for years and years. Clarksville native, you went to Murray State for a while, went out west. You're back in the area, and you're working with lots of folks in this program. Tell me who comes to you.
Typically seniors, 55 years and older, who are income eligible and unemployed. And usually it's folks who have retired, receiving Social Security, and need to supplement their income and also perhaps just to spice up their life a little bit by getting out.
What do you do once you meet a person who is in that general framework? What happens?
Well, we meet with them and determine their eligibility. And once that's determined, we do some assessment with them to determine what their skills are and what skills they would like to update and learn in order to go on to gain employment.
And how do you get those skills achieved?
We place them with host agencies in their community, and they are trained while on the job earning money.
Sounds like a sweet deal. What's the process and where do you come into it?
Well, I meet with them first and help them to be placed at the host agency. We work with them, any issues that they might have on the job. The host agencies provide the training. I provide support that might be needed. I also work with them on job search skills, job retention skills, resume writing, just anything that they would need in order to be able to gain unsubsidized employment.
What do you see when you place people?
Well, you see people who really enjoy getting up and coming to work every day. They love what they do. They love the people around them. And they have a lot to offer. Most of these folks have a lot of experience. Most people have worked a good part of their lives, and they bring a lot to an organization.
So there is a time limit for being with you, and then what are the expectations?
We hope that each person will gain unsubsidized employment. It doesn't have to be full-time. It can be part-time in the community where they live. We do offer follow-up after they gain unsubsidized employment to help them with any issues that might arise. We can provide some supportive services that they might need.
You mentioned that you're especially interested in employers being aware of this resource as well. How many people are you dealing with now in this program?
I have 18 people on the roll right now. I have 27 available slots in 7 purchase area counties. I'd like for them to understand that if I contacted them on the behalf of a participant or if a CSEP participant contacted them, that the CSEP program really provides sort of a reference for them. They've demonstrated their abilities to work. We know exactly what skills they have, and it's like a known entity to the employer. It's not just some stranger coming in.
So 20 hours a week, 7 1/4 an hour, and the placement is it for 24 months? Then 48 months maximum. How does that work?
Individual enrollment is expected to be 24 to 27 months. Usually we like to have people at one host agency for about a year. Then we like to transfer them or significantly change their duties so that we expand their training experience and therefore their employability. There is a 48-month lifetime durational limit. If they had to leave the program due to some sort of life experience, illness, or perhaps they got a job that didn't work out, could come back to the program with approval, and we could take them back in and continue training.
Tell me about some success story.
Recently, we had a Graves County resident who had been in the program. She left for unsubsidized employment. It didn't work out. She came back, received some more training, and then obtained a job in Nashville. And she has relocated to Nashville. She's living with a friend. They got a swimming pool. They're living large, enjoying life.
Some of the others you might want to share life stories that you feel particularly close to.
We have a lot of good relationships that are built at the host agencies. And many times, I'm working with a fellow right now who, once he gains unsubsidized employment, his intention is to come back and volunteer at the host agency.
We reiterate that the initial placements are in nonprofit or governmental agencies that often don't have budgets to complete the workforce they need.
That's correct.
This is a vital placement for the agency into which the person is going, in addition to the person receiving training.
That's right.
Where do people get in touch with you, and how do you get started?
The best way is to contact me at West Kentucky Allied Services. It's 270-247-4046. Email Jackie, J-A-C-K-I-E dot E at W-K-A-S dot info. Here in Callaway County, they can go to the Murray Career Center, which is down at 5th and Poplar.
You have various positions in various counties. What's available now?
We've got some positions in Callaway County at the Senior Center. We've got several other host agencies that might be able to accommodate somebody. In outlying counties, McCracken County, we've got some positions available. And also, we're going to be having some openings coming up in Graves County.
It just seems to me that in the process of working with these people, you must have an awful lot of good vibes.
Yeah, it's terrific. You know, seniors are great to work with. They really enjoy it. They got a good work ethic. They're hard workers, and typically they're pretty happy to be there.
Excellent. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jackie Eubanks coordinates the CSEP program, which is Senior Community Service Employment Program out of West Kentucky Allied Services.
After the break, we'll meet the new executive director of the Penroyal Arts Council and find out how one Kentucky library is turning to marketing to keep patrons coming in. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Margaret Prim is the new executive director of the Penroyal Arts Council. She's taking over for retiring director Carol Barta. Kate Lochte spoke with Prim this week to learn more about her and her plans for the council and the season ahead.
Margaret Prim writes about food for the Kentucky New Era, and you also run a clothing business?
Yeah. That's correct. I've been doing the New Era column for about a year and a half, and it's called What's on the Menu, and I totally enjoy it. I thought I'm just a self-taught cook, but I thought it was all about the food when I first started writing the column, and it's kind of grown into all about the story. So it's really been fun. I've enjoyed it a lot. My clothing business I've been doing for 10 years. I rep for a company out of New York, and it's a seasonal-type business. It's allowed me to just meet some great, great women in the area and work with women and do a lot of fundraising on that end. And I thought, hey, why not? I've always been interested in the Arts Council, and I'm very excited to be here.
Well, you've served on the board of directors of the Arts Council for a while.
I have.
One of the first things you're doing is you're celebrating Carol Barta's retirement with a reception next week.
Absolutely. That's going to be next Thursday here at the Depot from 4 to 6. And we hope everybody will come out and just express how grateful they are to have had Carol at our helm for such a few years. She's been here 7.5 years and has just done a fantastic job, and wish her well in her retirement.
Amen to that. And again, it is next Thursday from 4 to 6 at the Train Depot. And
that's correct.
Then you are also prepping for a magic act
We are prepping for a magic act. I'm so excited about it. I think it's going to be something that we've done some magic shows in the past, but I think this is a little, you know, a new flair for Hopkinsville. I think it's something that we've never seen, and it's called Nelson Illusion Smoke and Mystery Tour, and it kind of draws its inspiration from the steampunk art movement. So there'll be a lot of big props, and there'll be things that have top hats and goggles and antique clocks and hot air balloons and flying machines, and so we're real excited. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, I think that the kids will be really excited as well, because this magic troupe is the kind where they have the boxes and they cut people up, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
And move them around.
That's correct. And they'll also provide, we have a program at the Penroyal Arts Council called the SMARTS program. It's Students Meeting the Arts. And they will be providing performances for our school students as well at the Alhambra. So that'll happen the day before the show, on Thursday the 24th, and then the morning of the show. And that's for grades 4 through 12. So students will actually come to the Alhambra, and they craft a show just for them.
I need to go back and say that people don't really cut people up, but I watched the YouTube, and it's one of those things where a beautiful woman gets in a box, and then the sheets go through the box, and then they move the boxes around, and her head goes down to where her toes were, et cetera. So that's lots of fun, and it's one of those. They also do that thing where the woman goes into a trance, and she all of a sudden they put her up parallel about 6 feet above the ground.
Yeah.
and do the brooms above and below so you can see there's nothing holding her there.
It's going to be illusion.
Tell me more about the Nelson family, if you will.
Jeff Nelson is a master illusionist, and this is and Sherry is also an award-winning performer who has just elevated the art of magic. And the third generation of their family is working, and their daughter Lynn is working in the show as well. I've just spoken to them on the phone. I can't wait to meet them in person. I think they, from all the reviews that I've seen of the show, everybody's just been blown away by it. So we're excited to bring it to the Alhambra.
I didn't really get, you know, I went around asking all my younger compadres here, what is steampunk? And they told me about, they reminded me of the Wild Wild West and the whole kind of affectionate look back at when steam ran the world.
That's right. That's right. I in our press releases, there's a, you can look on Wikipedia, and it has some interesting information about it as well. But I think this kind of touches a younger audience for us, and that's something that's important for us to as the Arts Council to be sure we're bringing a great variety of things that attract, you know, a diverse audience. So we're hoping that this is going to be very fun for all ages.
So this is January 25th at 7:30 at the Alhambra.
That's correct.
Now, do a rundown of the rest of the season you've got coming up.
We've got one of our biggest shows of the season, Celtic Crossroads, and we feel very fortunate to have them at the Alhambra. And that's actually going to be on a Monday, February 25th at 7:30. And they're a critically acclaimed show from Ireland, and it's just an explosion of energy. It kind of marries Irish dance with song. It incorporates some Irish bluegrass, some gypsy and jazz. It's a big show, and we're real excited about that. And then our final show of the year is on Saturday, April 13th at 7:30, and it's Daddy Took the T-Bird Away. And this is from a Kentucky performing group from the Pine Knob Theater. And it's kind of a rollicking musical with a lot of songs from the 50s and the 60s. So that'll be fun for folks as well. In between that time, we also have the Missoula Children's Theater that comes to Hopkinsville and has a longstanding tradition here. And that's an in-residency program. And we'll begin that in a couple of weeks. And that's a pretty incredible program that was started in the 70s. And you get professional actors that come in. We'll have auditions at Belmont School. And what they do is come in and bring an interview for or audition for with local talent. So there'll probably be 150 to 200 children that audition for this, and about 50 of them will incorporate into a show. They'll rehearse that week, and the show will be at the end of the week. So that's really a very neat thing.
How does the Pennyroyal Arts Council survive, Margaret?
You know, we survive on a shoestring, and from private donations, from individuals, businesses, foundations, and then our grant writing process is pretty robust. In fact, that's kind of the main thing I'm working on. We've got a huge grant with the Kentucky Arts Council that is due next Tuesday. So first mode of business to me is to make sure we've got some money coming in.
Excellent.
And we are also funded heavily by the Christian County Board of Education. I met with them yesterday. We've got a great partnership with them. And that helps fund some of the shows the shows that we bring for the school students.
Wonderful. Well, come back and talk again, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Margaret Prim is the Executive Director of the Pennyroyal Arts Council in Hopkinsville.
It may not come as any surprise to learn that in this age, where old-fashioned analog books appear to be giving ground to cloud computing and e-readers, public libraries in the U.S. and in Kentucky sometimes have to worry about marketing to keep patrons coming in. This year, for example, the staff at Lexington's public library system will be working on a new image for the organization. Part of their campaign includes an effort to boost card-carrying members by some 8,000 people within 6 months. Kentucky Public Radio Stu Johnson reports on their rebranding effort.
Like most days, the children's section of the library is a busy place. Randy Lawhon comes to the Central Library almost daily, and his son is there about once a week. On this day, his three-year-old was playing a learning game.
It's just a magnet, word building board to help him learn how to spell and use his words and syllables. They have computer access for all the children, little games on them, learning. They're all learning games. It really benefits the children.
For over 100 years, Lexington residents have taken their kids to the library. But not too long ago, there were no games at the library, only books. And that's the image many people may still have. Kelly Dean, who heads outreach services for the library, says too often they're still thought of as a grocery store for books.
We're in a grocery store. You just go and you pick up what you need. A lot of times you already have what you need at home, but we want to be like a kitchen atmosphere where you can do things with what you have. And so that's what we're doing a lot with, I think, with a lot of our computer classes and a lot of our programs for children and things like that. You can actually put the knowledge that you have to work, to put it to use in the library.
Within recent memory, libraries have expanded services to offer all kinds of content in a variety of media. Given such changes, Library Director Ann Hammond says they need to foster a new image, which is captured in a new logo.
It's been described as a number of different things. People see a book with the pages fluttering open. Some people see crazy hair. Some people see who knows what. But it's meant to spark the imagination and say, what are the possibilities?
Hammond says their old logo, which was more than 20 years old, showed the Central Library building. She says the idea is to get a new look that's energetic and up-to-date. The new logo is a blue, red, and orange depiction of pages as they flip in a book. It can be found on billboards, buses, and magnets, along with a new slogan, "Reading is just the beginning." Of course, library users can still check out a hardcover book from one of the system's six locations, but in recent years, electronic books have come on in a big way. Some might think e-books would cut into a library circulation, but Hammond says it hasn't been the case.
The e-books, I think, have been kind of an affirmative thing for libraries. They've shown that we're not just old-fashioned. We're not just all about print books. We're changing with the world, and we're adapting and offering things that people need as the new things come along. We're right there with them.
There are also mobile apps which allow users to check out, reserve, and renew books and other content. Computer services are also a big part of what's offered, with access provided to the internet. There are computer classes, digital studios, and additional assistance with research.
We've just started something here at Central called Book a Librarian, where you can make an appointment and get one-on-one time with a librarian if you've got an in-depth research project, or you're doing some genealogy, or if you just like to have a tour of the library. We can do that for you.
New technologies can also be used to bring history alive. The Kentucky Room contains all the historical archives about the Bluegrass State. Virginia McClure is head librarian for the Kentucky Room.
We're looking at ways that we can bring the contents of the Kentucky Room and bring them out into the open. And so we're looking at digitizing items and making them more available on the website, creating web galleries of images that we have. And we're revamping our local history index to make that more accessible.
Director Ann Hammond admits the rebranding of the public library system is not all about keeping up with the times. Part of it is to restore the community's confidence in the library system. A few years ago, a library director was terminated after reports of excessive spending. That case is still in the courts, but at the library, Hammond says they're trying to get back on track.
There was some negative publicity around the library, and this rebranding effort was an attempt to say, that's in the past. That was not about the library. That was an isolated incident involving a specific person, and that's not who we are and where we're going now.
So, the beginning of 2013 marks 107 years of library service to the Lexington community. Library officials hope thousands of new patrons will take a much deeper interest in their services this new year. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Stu Johnson.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Whitney Jones, Casey Northcutt, and John Walker. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
We welcome your questions or comments about the stories you've heard today. You can email them to msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu, post them to our Facebook page, or tweet them to @WKMS. You can find links to all three at wkms.org. You can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.